leaning into failure and not being afraid of it is really important too.
We are joined by Dr. Desiree Testa, the team psychologist for the Buffalo Bills. She earned her PhD in sport and counseling psychology from Florida State and began her career working with athletes at William & Mary during her internship. Dr. Festa then led a private practice in Charlotte, consulting with UNC Charlotte, Appalachian State, and the Charlotte Hornets, as well as a variety of NASCAR teams. In 2020, she joined the Bills full-time, becoming one of the few embedded psychologists in the NFL. Dr. Festa plays a vital role in player development, rookie success programs, and in-game mental performance. She's heavily involved in coach support and the team's draft evaluation processes. Her experience bridges the gap between clinical care and performance enhancement. In this episode, we talk about her definition of mental toughness, the psychological impact of how coaches talk to their players, and a couple simple mental training techniques coaches can integrate into practices to not only help their players, but coaches. Please welcome to the podcast, Dr. Desiree Festa.
Dr. Dish Basketball, the number one selling shooting machine in the world, provides the most innovative game-like training with on-demand workouts, multiplayer stat tracking, and instant analytics that allow coaches and players to be better every day. All you have to do is mention Rising Coaches for an exclusive discount on a Dr. Dish shooting machine for your team.
Welcome, coaches and everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Alan Major, Doug Caputo here. Today, we are graced. We have a little spin on things. We don't necessarily have somebody on the coaching side, but we have somebody that is an extremely pivotal point to all of athletics. We have the team sport psychologist with the Buffalo Bills, Dr. Desiree Festa. Dr. Festa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on a coaching podcast. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Of course. I know Al's probably going to laugh, but this is my bread and butter. This is the type of thing that I always talk about with him. I always love this side of things. I think it's so pivotal, and we have people on here all the time that talk about it's so much bigger than coaching. You have to be able to know how to work with kids, talk with kids, and so on, and so many different things. So this is, I think, something that's going to be really huge for people. But one of the first things that I want to ask is just, what got you into this side? We always ask coaches what got them into the business, right? But at least for you, what got you into this side, going more with the mental aspect, working with student athletes, not only athletes, but coaches, and you being at the professional level? But what got you into this side of the career?
Yeah. So my initial passion for sports psychology started when I was in high school. I was an athlete that played all sports. I was just really passionate about participating in sports. And I also had an interest in psychology since middle school. So fortunately for me, I was able to find my passions early in life. And then actually my mom was taking undergraduate courses at our local university in psychology and overheard one of the professors mention this word sports psychology. No more elaboration, nothing else, but there is a psychology related to sports. Came home, told me, hey, I heard of this field, sports psychology. You might be really interested in it. That's all she knew, and that's all it went at that point. And then from there, I did my own research. I became even more curious. I talked to my coaches about it, who didn't really know much about it either. And this was a while ago. So sports psychology was an emerging field at that time. And it was really important for me to choose an undergrad that somewhat put me on the path of sports psychology to make sure it put me in that direction. So I went to a small school in Pennsylvania called Eastern University. It had a sports psychology course. I can major in psychology and minor in sport and coaching. So that was my way of devising a sports psychology degree in undergrad. And then from there, I did my master's in sports psych at Florida State. And then I got my PhD in counseling psych. And through all that training and all that education, I really became more and more passionate about sports psychology. Fortunately, at the time when I went to Florida State, they allowed us to work with the student athletes right away. So I got training right out of undergrad and grad school with athletes right away. And that reaffirmed my passion for this field. And then through time, working with collegiate athletes and professional athletes, I ended up here at the Buffalo Bills, being full-time, fully embedded with the organization.
Wow. Let me ask you this. Did the way that you were coached throughout high school, and you played multiple sports and you had multiple coaches, and when you play multiple sports, typically you excel in one and you're a little bit more dominant in one, and you're a little bit more of a role player in another. But, and so you're coached differently in every sport that you're participating in. Did you find that had an influence on you as well, the way you were coached in high school, that kind of pushed you towards this field?
Yeah, I was actually a better track athlete, and my track coaches were really influential. Track could have been a potential option for me going in the college direction, but I actually ended up doing a year of tennis in undergrad. So I was just the all-around person athlete. My track coaches in particular were very focused on the mental side, like visualization. I remember I high jumped, and I specifically remember my track coach talking about, hear your steps before you take your steps. So I'd close my eyes and I would hear the rhythm of my steps before I jumped. And so that was them integrating what they knew about the mental side of stuff. So there was seeds being planted at that time when it came to the mental side, particularly from my track coaches.
Yeah, because there's a number of steps with high jumping. Yeah. Leading up to, it's like a certain number, and you have to repeat that number because that maintains your strides, rhythm.
Yeah, and your strides change over time too. So they get closer and more staggered when you get closer to the bar. So you just hear that pattern. So that was a really, I guess that was just an influential piece to me when it came to coaches having an impact on my sports psych career. And then when I went to undergrad, our sports psych class was actually taught by one of our soccer coaches who was also a professor at our university. And I was able to form a really good relationship with him. And we actually have principles of coaching classes, and we would just study coaching along with the minor of sport and coaching. So it was really interesting.
To be able to learn the coaching side of it, but also the psychology side of it, that sounds like the best of both worlds. That maybe I should go back to school. I'm going to consider it now, but no, that's amazing. And I just want to make sure to tell everybody too, not only have you been working with the football side of things, I know you've been with the Buffalo Sabres. I know you've been more on the basketball side as well, so you can really relate to a lot of people with App State, UNC Charlotte, the Charlotte Hornets. And then obviously there's a lot of places I know, NFL, and just with you having these broad experiences, being able to work with all different athletes, not just like one brand or one sport, but you've been working with a lot of different. So if I guess just jumping into when you're talking and working with athletes, that now obviously sport dependent, there's a lot of things that can go into this, like off the floor or on, what are some common like mental challenges that you see people face, especially maybe with their coach or even against it, just as an athlete overall?
Yeah, I'll speak for athletes in general, especially as you get through the higher levels, college to professional. One of the common themes is stress, anxiety, pressure, expectations of others, expectations of themselves, navigating those things. So that's a common area to focus on, is how can we manage that stress, pressure, anxiety, and how can we reframe it into a competitive advantage? So one of the things I talk to athletes about is pregame. You may feel that the butterfly, or I'm air quoting here, the good nerves, right, is a common term we hear in sports. So instead of players fighting against that feeling and believing that they are not ready to perform because they're feeling anxious, let's leverage that and reframe it as excitement or body getting ready, or adrenaline is turning on. This feeling is your body getting ready for competition instead of something that they're trying to fight against or suppress. And there's actually been research studies on this, on what you do with that feeling of nerves. When people are trying to calm themselves down, when athletes are trying to just calm themselves down and get super relaxed, that's really counter to what they need to do to perform. Like, their heart rate does have to start going. Their muscles have to start pumping. So let's leverage that into a positive instead of seeing it something is that you got to fight against.
Yes, Ed. This is a little bit of a spinoff of Doug's question, but, and I did this, I worked a camp in Lithuania a couple of years ago, and it was kids that were 10 to 18, basketball camp. One of the first things I told them is that your mistakes this week are opportunities.
Mm,
Don't hang your head when you kick a ball out of bounds in a ball handling drill. Let's catch yourself and then find a way to turn this into a learning opportunity. So
yes,
obviously mistakes at your level and at the professional level, college even, because of social media, because of ESPN bloopers, mistakes are almost like highlighted now as call outs in a sense.
Yeah.
But athletes have to take that mistake in the moment and turn it into a learning opportunity. How at that, at your level, how do you help athletes reframe their mistakes?
Yeah, Alan, exactly what you do with the 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds. And I like how that you're using the growth mindset research from Carol Dweck when it comes to reframing hardships into opportunities or challenges. It's the same thing, just helping the players see them as growth opportunities or learning moments. I tell athletes that your brain learns better from correcting a mistake than doing it correct the first time. Just that struggle of trying to correct it, you actually end up having a deeper understanding of the mechanism of how it works. So actually that mistake, for example, that mistake in a preseason game can help you do better midseason. So not being afraid of the mistake making is huge. And fear of failure is a common experience for athletes. The more they're afraid, sometimes the more that they could get mentally handicapped or hijacked. Leaning into failure and not being afraid of it is really important too.
One thing that I have seen tremendously, and I'll be the first one to say, it was me as an athlete, and now going back, I can easily relate to the guys I coach, because I can easily say, I know what you're like. If a coach yells at you heavy and says, I don't want you shooting this shot or doing this, it could play with you a little bit. Although maybe you're not the best at it. You might think you're better at it because you work on it, but confidence, What role does confidence with that stress, that pressure, those mistakes that could obviously alter your confidence going into the game, and then going into the game, it could be completely shattered. What does confidence play a role in performance? And then how can that be worked on?
For the word confidence, other words can also mean similar to confidence, trust, belief. I lean into those words more than the word confidence. And I'll tell you why. 10 years ago, probably 10 plus roughly, I was working with an international tennis player from another country. And he said, you Americans care so much about confidence. What's most important is having the mental skills. And are you equipped with the skills to handle the situation? And I thought that was a very insightful statement that this tennis player said, because it's not just a feeling of confidence. What really makes you believe in yourself and trust in yourself is your preparation, not only with the practice, the game plan, having the skill set, but also the preparation in your mental skills, equipping yourself with different techniques and strategies when you hit adversity and you hit tough times, that you have this whole toolbox of resources that you could dip into and get yourself out of it. So confidence is important, but I think what's most important is trusting self and trusting that preparation, which includes the mental component.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because some players have moments of confidence. It's like the equivalent of getting hot.
Yeah.
Like when you get hot, or you're in a rhythm, or you're in a groove, then you can, that's the ebb and flow of confidence. Whereas, like you said, trusting your work, trusting your preparation, trusting your mistake response system.
Yes.
And when in the heat of the moment, that to me is, I see what you're saying. It's a difference between something that may come and go versus something that's sustainable. And the trusting part is sustainable, where sometimes the confidence can be fleeting.
Exactly. Because sometimes we equate confidence with this emotion. And exactly like you said, it can be fleeting, but a lot of times we talk about it in a very black and white way. Oh, that player's confident, that player is not. Where it's not a black and white concept, or I am confident or I'm not confident. It's not black or white. It's really a skill that you're developing, you're nurturing, and you're constantly working on, even through the professional level. Even if you're a Pro Bowler, All Pro, Hall of Famer, you're always working on that skill.
Yeah. So there's degrees of it as opposed to the black and white. It's just varying degrees. Yeah.
Exactly. Got it. And like you said, in certain situations, you could be very confident or really trust your preparation in one area, but then in another area of your game, it might be different too. Yeah, it's not quite black and white.
Yeah, yeah. There's the 58 minutes of the game, or at least in football, or 46 minutes, and then there's that last 2 minutes.
Yes.
And so, some are special. The Bradys of the world, or the right now, Shea Gillis-Alexander, last 2 minutes, he's got supreme trust in his ability to close out a game. So, yes. Whereas some people struggle in that last 2 minutes, they're great for the first 98%, but then that last 2%, it's a different deal. Yeah.
Speaking on confidence, it's that heat check, Alan. You said you hit a couple shots, you go in, throw up that heat check, that third or fourth one, and you're just hoping for the best, and it's just let it go from five.
Right.
I can relate to that completely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every now and then you see a couple go in, you're like, all right, we just got to throw up a third one. It's gonna that'll tell you how the rest of the night's going to go. It's not even confidence at that point. No, but I love that, because especially one thing that I kind of want to spin it on to is I've seen coaches, and I'll be even like the first one to say it's happened to me before. Coaches have cut your confidence in a sense. So going back to I played under a really old school head coach when I was in college. Phenomenal guy. Absolutely loved him. But if you were a big, even if you could shoot, he did not want you shooting. And that was like his thing. The assistants would tell me to shoot it. He would tell me not to. And it was like, okay, one person's building confidence, the other person's tearing it down, but he's the one in charge. Which one do you listen to? The one who's controlling the playing time, obviously. When I'm working with like guys that I'm coaching, if that same exact situation happens, those guys like don't have the confidence. So you try to build it up. I guess talk about how coaches can ultimately damage kids' confidences, but then also help build those up too.
It's amazing because at the professional level, players will still quote a coach that they had through their developmental years, whether it's high school, college, some coach that had a strong influence on where they are now. So they really internalize those messages because the coach helps them get a mental blueprint of how they should understand their successes, how they should understand their failures. What do they do when they make mistakes? Like that narrative can get ingrained a lot of times into players' heads where they're still, that narrative is still there in a positive way or a way that can get in the way, and that we're working through that those negative scripts that they internalize over time. So coaches have a huge influence. And something I was going to say earlier, and I want to make sure I put in here too, is just recently, I had one of our coaches said, man, sometimes I feel like I'm a psychologist. I'm like, we're both in the field of changing human behavior. So there is a ton of psychology in coaching that you're doing all the time. And I really appreciate the coaches that recognize the psychological component because many times they could promote more of a psychologically healthy or resilient culture when they do that. One of the things, Doug, that you said was super important is the coaching staff being on the same page. It's not uncommon at any level where you have a head coach saying one thing, an assistant coach is saying another, and the coaches feel that misalignment and that inconsistency. And that alone can degrade some trust and confusion. Who do I listen to? And then how am I supposed to understand myself and what my role is and what I need to be? So there's already doubt that the seed of doubt is creeping in when there's this inconsistency in coaching. Also, what a coach praises and recognizes is influential. So let's go back to that growth mindset research from Carol Dweck coming out of Stanford, where they did a lot of research on kids when it came to developing the growth mindset research. When coaches, parents, and teachers really focus on praising natural talent and natural skill, sometimes that creates what they call more of a fixed mindset in the athlete. They're just riding out that natural talent that they have. But when that talent only gets them so far, then they're stuck. They don't have the skills to problem solve. They don't have the skills to be resilient. They don't have the skills to persevere and push through because they've just been riding out that natural talent. And at some point, there will be a ceiling where that talent is not quite enough. So what is critical for coaches, especially at the younger years, for them to praise that problem-solving skills, praise when an athlete overcomes a mistake and learns from it. Praise when an athlete takes feedback, praise those things more so than, hey, you're just naturally gifted, you're super athletic, man, you're fast and you have really good speed. Yeah, those things do matter, but really by praising these psychological skills, you're helping develop their mental toolbox.
Oh man, that's awesome. Now, one of my, I do a little bit of consulting with a friend of mine, and he had me watch his practice recently. And so I sent him some notes, and I literally put in my notes, you know, like whatever gets praised will get repeated. And so his team is currently in their early summer workouts, and they're trying to see where they are and do some foundational things. And I'm like, hey, if they continue to do this right here, please make a big deal when they do it, because whatever gets praised will get repeated. But I'm a firm believer that the four most important words a coach can say to a player is, I believe in you. And think what gets cemented in players' minds is, and I also think our job as coaches is, how can we see the greatness in them before they see it themselves? And then create a vision for that, and then walk either alongside of them, in front of them, behind them, arm in arm, however that looks, to get to that destination. But yeah, just like you said, I just love the idea of what you said there about making a big deal about growth as opposed to this like static thing that's athleticism or speed or whatever that may be, because you're right. And we see that all the time in draft picks. They're projected up to this point, and then it's like, God, why didn't this guy pan out? And it's probably because he was always told, man, you're so good at this. You're fast. You're great. You're the number five ranked ninth grader in America. So what? No, what a great distinction. That's rich.
Yeah, I think you need to clip that phrase, whatever gets praised gets repeated, because that is true from a coaching standpoint, but also the athlete themselves. So I've, through the years, have worked with many athletes that care so much about doing well, a tremendous amount, so much so sometimes I'm telling them they have to care a little bit less because they put so much internal pressure on themselves. But one of the questions I ask them is, all right, after practice today, what are you replaying in your mind? And a lot of times it's that one or two mistakes that they made that they put on repeat. And you do have to learn from it, and you do have to correct yourself from it. But sometimes they hyper-focus on it so much, what they're focusing on also gets repeated, and that they be increasing mistake-making because they're so hyper-focused on mistakes as well. So even for their own selves, what they spend a lot of mental energy on can also get repeated as well.
Yeah, what you focus on. That's one thing that I've noticed, and this is, it's on topic, but like one thing I've noticed is when I'm talking to people now, I'm training myself to listen the way they, just the way they talk about themselves, essentially. Because if somebody says something about, oh yeah, oh man, my bad, I'm an idiot, I didn't mean to do that. It's like you're putting it in your head, you know what I mean? Like you're putting it in your head that, oh, you're calling yourself an idiot. What you put out there is ultimately what ends up coming back, I feel like. So like you putting it out there into the world, now people are going to start, even if people don't think that, into something stupid, like something little. I think it's something that's so meaningful because you're training yourself that. You're reiterating it. You're putting it in your own brain. So that
I
think
is huge. Apologizing a lot too. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like I think that's great awareness on your end, Doug, is how people talk about themselves and talk about their experiences and what they go through. What's that narrative in their head?
What really opened my mind up to this is you don't really know what a lot of your players have gone through until you actually hear their story. And I've been able to hear, this past summer has been a little more difficult for our team, just some up and downs with transitions and stuff. And one of the guys just opened up to me, and I didn't know half of this stuff. But I guess my thing, like, or question is, when you're working with guys that, you know, they start opening up to you, they want to be emotionally, they want to be able to open up to you because they think that you're somebody who you can talk to, you're a coach, you're a peer for them. What's like the best way for a coach to be able to create that culture? Sit down, talk with them, have that one-on-one conversation, but then also still keep that, oh, yell at you, I'll cuss you out on the floor, but then we can turn it off once we get into the office.
Yeah, Doug, I really appreciate the fact that you're asking that question and caring about creating a culture where players can feel like they can open up and trust you more. First is having a leader and a coach who is consistent. mentally and emotionally consistent, showing up consistent, regardless of the highs and the lows that's going on with the season. When a coach can show up consistent, that predictability helps the players feel safer, and it helps the coach themselves too. So they're not emotionally riding the highs and lows. So that consistency is important. And especially at the professional level, players, their level of awareness is elite. It's part of the reason why they're an elite player. And they can notice those differences in a coach of how they show up when things are going well and when things aren't going well. So being consistent is important. And then also the coach, especially the head coach, modeling vulnerability and them sharing of what their personal experiences are like, or their opening up emotionally, gives permission for their players to do that as well. And then also a coach who is willing to own their own mistakes, right? If you want your players to own mistakes, a coach that models that behavior is super important. The other day, I was having a conversation with folks from Special Forces, and there was the leader of the team of that particular group or team was present. And he talked about the importance of him taking ownership and accountability right away as a leader and really leaning into that. So that sets the stage for everyone around him to take ownership, because ownership is a huge piece in the military, taking ownership, you taking it yourself, and then also being aware that you made a mistake as well is very important. And so, yes, consistency, vulnerability, authenticity, ownership, that helps. Also, building a relationship with your players one-on-one is important. I know the seasons are long and they're busy. Sometimes this is best done in the off season or your preseason before you get into the busyness of a competitive season. But if you could sit down and spend some time one-on-one with that player and really get to know them. And one of the cheat codes that I give coaches is make sure the player is talking at least 70% of the time and the coach is only talking 30%. So really use your active listening skills and let that player guide the conversation and let them feel heard. That is so important. When a player feels heard and understood, that could give you a lot of in the future with then giving that player hard feedback or hard criticism. They just need to know that you are in their corner and you are really trying to get the best out of them. And by doing that is when that player feels heard and understood by their coach.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. Ultimately, I think the best player coach relationships literally become partnerships. And by partnership, meaning, all right, my goal is to help get the best out of you. And every time you take a step forward, what happens is, okay, now the gun is turned back on me to find a way to help you take another step. Mm. So I'm actually growing with you, because I've got to develop, and all I'm going to do is turn around and give my development back to you as a player. Player well grows, said. Coach grows, player grows, coach grows. And then when they both understand this is what we're doing, yep. Then it's really, really, really fun, because you're literally challenging each other along the player's journey. And Greg Oden was a player that I coached a long time ago at Ohio State, and we were texting last night, literally. And he's doing some big man camps and things like that, where he's now worked with post players. And he talked about some of the stuff we used to do. And I said, look, man, I had to steal from people to get ready for you, because you were so smart that I would show you something, and then 3 weeks later, he'd be like, hey, you remember that footwork thing you talked about 3 weeks ago? And if you forgot, he'd be like, oh, you don't remember? And so I thanked him for making me better, because I had to hijack things from pro guys and European guys just to get ready for him. But I think that's really the essence of coaching player relationships, is that it's really fun when you're both in it together. The coach knows it. The player knows it. And then it's like, hey, man, let's just, as long as we have you, let's get you as good as you can. And let's just see where that takes you. And that, to me, is when it's a blast.
Yeah. And Alan, through your example, that's also emphasizing the point of explaining your communication and the intention behind it with your players and why you're doing what you're doing, whether that's hard coaching or encouragement in the beginning of the season, really setting the tone and explaining what the intentions are behind your communication and why you do what you do helps the player not do the guessing game as much of like, why is coach doing this? Why is he doing that? Now they understand the methods behind what you do. And so that's important as well.
Yeah. Let me ask this. I know we asked a couple people this before, and I just love the different answers you'll get from it, but just your definition of mental toughness. I know so many times coaches are standing there, you got to be mentally tough. That's nothing that you just wake up the next day and say, hey, I'm going to be mentally tough today. Like, I feel like that is exactly how what you were saying in the beginning. It's a muscle that has to be trained long term. So what is your definition of mental toughness, and then how can it be trained?
Yeah, Doug, once again, I'm so glad that you're asking this question. And the term mental toughness is a hot topic. And the field is actually moving away from the term mental toughness, actually, because the belief of mental toughness is let's suppress emotions, let's suppress the discomfort, and let's power through like we're machines. So for example, I was working with an elite runner years ago, and he had so much anxiety about mental toughness that he thought he had to be a mental machine and not have one thought of doubt, has to be completely positive, has to push through every ounce of pain, every moment of every day, and it would stress him out. So he was having this perfectionistic interpretation of what mental toughness is. But the field of sports psychology actually is moving away from that term, and we're moving into terms more mental resilience, where you are equipping yourselves with different tools and skills to help navigate or adapt to challenging times and to overcome that adversity mountain, necessarily just blindly pushing through, ignoring your thoughts, ignoring your feelings. It's more of accepting that hardness and that those tough times, accepting it, which doesn't always mean you're agreeing with it, but you're accepting it is what it is. And then how can you move forward with the tough feelings and the tough emotion and the challenging times instead of let's just ignore it's not happening. So it's more about building resilience than it is building toughness.
Yeah, no, that's because resilience is toughness in a sense.
Yeah.
But it's like the word toughness, I agree with what you're saying. It's like push it down. Let's
pretend it's not happening. And then
sweep it under the rug, you know?
Exactly. And then what can happen a lot of times, if you do not spend time recognizing those thoughts, those emotions, it's like an app that's running in the background on your phone and it's draining your battery. You want to bring those thoughts and emotions to the forefront and then deal with them and learn how to move forward with them or reframe them rather than just push them down. And I've seen this so many times by us bringing this stuff to the forefront that's driving a lot of maybe your stress and anxiety. Like, how can we move forward with it? Like, I could give you an example in this, just the psychology world, which relates to sport, but also all of psychology. For example, let's say someone experiences a panic attack, which happens, which can happen in sport, especially. A lot of times their fear of the next panic attack creates the panic attack because they're worried about it. They are fearful of it. Like, oh crap, what happens if another panic attack? Instead of reframing it as, okay, another panic attack's going to happen. You're going to ride through it. You're going to lean into your breathing. You're going to tell yourself, hey, I've experienced these feelings and emotions before. And then you will get to the other side of it. So instead of the goal being no panic attacks because I cannot handle this feeling, it's more of accepting, hey, panic attacks may come, but you are equipped and you can handle these things and you can ride through that discomfort and we'll get to the other side because you've proven it before, because you've already gone through a panic attack in the past. So you will be able to do it again. So instead of never dealing with a hardship, it's accepting the hardship may come. And as a result, a lot of times those panic attacks are less likely to happen because you're not so fearful of it. You can handle it if it comes and you will get to the other side.
Yeah, it's funny. There's like a common thread running through a lot of what you're saying, that hopefully coaches don't miss is part of our jobs, in addition to trying to help players maximize their abilities, both physically, mentally, it's also showing them how to get to the other side of the rough times.
Yep.
And I'm going to be there when on the other side of it, you're going to be fine on the other side of it. And what can we learn after getting to the other side of it that's going to help us move forward?
Exactly.
And pull on this for a second. What how can coaches, and I think sometimes we're in such a transactional, fast twitch society, how can coaches, or how do you encourage coaches to encourage players to have more joy? I know winning and losing is a big part of, obviously at the professional level, let's face it, it is what it is. It's under the microscope 24/7. But I think some of the best teams, they have a joy in what they're doing, both individually and as a group. So is that something that you try to encourage coaches to have players? Because we can get so caught up in winning and losing that they miss the joy of what they're doing day to day.
Yes, Alan, I could go down this whole in this area, because when you are talking about joy, you are really talking about their intrinsic motivation. So if you want to look into this self-determination theory by DC and Ryan, it's a very well-researched motivational theory for years. And I'm going to boil it down to intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, which many people have probably really heard of, but I will just repeat it. Intrinsic motivation is you do the sport out of love, desire, passion, joy, curiosity. Just think about back in the day when you first started playing your sport as a kid and you just showed up because it was fun. Versus extrinsic motivation is you do the sport because you get something external out of it. A salary, a contract, status, awards. Nowadays, social media followers, there's a lot of extrinsic motivators to do your sport. Because of our youth sports system currently, one of the things that we are robbing our players from, our young players, is that intrinsic motivation, that internal desire and love for the sport. Now, young athletes are somewhat like professional athletes. For example, we had our high school team, our local high school team here in Buffalo, won the state softball tournament. They got a police escort coming back into their high school. So I was like, wow, youth sports has changed since I played. But because it's forming a little bit more into a business and it's so structured, players are losing that joy and they're losing it at a young age. You really have to foster that at a younger age. So it's less about wins and losses, and it's more about the development, the growth, the relationships that they form, the communication skills, the leadership skills, allowing the players to have some choice and autonomy over what they do. I would love it if athletes could just go play their sport and not one adult was watching at some point. It's just them playing. And they have to self-police and they have to self-reflect and think about, okay, why didn't I make this shot? What do I need to do different? And think about that stuff on their own versus always an outside adult doing that on their own. So if there's a way for coaches to bring players in more into the learning process, give them more autonomy over that growth, give them a little bit more choice. And then when a coach is showing passion for the sport and love for it, that can translate onto the player versus I'm stressed because I'm worried about losing my job, which we know coaches have a lot of stress because there's a high turnover at the coaching world at the collegiate and professional level. So if they could display that passion versus kind of the stress for their own job security, that can be helpful as well.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Yeah, I heard a stat and it's devastating. And it's disappointing. 70% of kids in youth sports, they give it up by the age of 13 and never touch it again. It hurts for two reasons, because one of their reasons for saying that is the car ride home. That was one of the reasons kids use for giving it up. Because like you said, their kids are doing stuff year round, as opposed to I played different sports, whatever was in season, I was playing it.
Right.
And it was fun. I wasn't as good as in all of them. Basketball was my thing. But what's disappointing about that and what people are missing, that becomes generational.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to when that 13-year-old is 33 and now they have kids. And what do you think their outlook when their kids decide to want to play sports? What do you think that parental outlook is going to be? On that, because that parent gave it up for various reasons. One of two things is probably going to happen. They're either going to discourage them from playing it, which is a very sad generational side effect. Or, I hate to say this, but even worse, they're going to try to relive whatever they went through their son or daughter.
Yep.
And now that's a whole different Pandora's box we're talking about. But so, but a lot of kids, they're saying it's because of this lack of joy. And so I think if we want players to have joy, we've got to set the tone by exhibiting joy. Exactly. And that doesn't always mean raw chest bumping, all that. Some days it's just, yo, man, good to see you. Player walks in the gym and just give them one of those. Like, to me, that's just a snippet of joy. Man, it's good to see you. Let's have a good one today.
Because it's that joy, Alan, and that intrinsic motivation that helps them get through the tough times and the adversity and the hardship, more so than those extrinsic reasons.
So I have so many questions that I could go off of all of these. We'll narrow down to one here. So just now staying on the coaches working with athletes, right? So maybe not even necessarily the parents wise, but the coaches working with athletes, I guess talking more practice wise or game implementing, is there anything that a coach, maybe one, two, three things that you can implement in practice to help in some way help your athletes? Like maybe is it its own drill? Is it a way you can implement it into a drill? Is there anything that you have seen or know of?
Yeah, but Doug, I'm really glad that you're asking this question, because integration of those mental skills into physical training is key, because they are going to integrate their mental skills while they're playing a game. So if you can train both of those things at the same time, that's excellent. I remember talking to a colleague who works with a collegiate basketball team that has done consistently well through the years. And one of the things the coaches did is when practice is a little chaotic or they're losing control of it, he pauses it and has the team take a breath. And they actually practice the skill of breathing in practice. I feel like in basketball, that could be easier than football. But if you just take a moment to pause and then practice the skill of breathing and self-regulating, like when things are out of control, let's take a breath and bring ourselves back into a space of more mental and emotional control and physical control by practicing that breathing. That's important, something a coach can do, and a coach can model that themselves too. Second, knowing your player's reset routine, or like you said, mistake management routines. Maybe there's a word or a saying or a cue that they do to help themselves mentally reset. You can encourage that as a coach. So let's say a player makes a mistake, they take a quick breath, and then they focus in on, let's say, their footwork or their eye discipline. Like, you could communicate that cue to help them get back on track and flush that play. The skill of resetting is really important in all sports. Football, because of the stop and go of the sport, it's easier for us to implement those reset routines, right? Because the play happens for 6 seconds, then there's a gap of time. Then
you got 30 seconds. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so there's a lot of opportunity for us to implement a reset routine. Basketball, it's constant going. So practicing that in practice, that quick turnaround and supporting your players, and that's a really important skill. And one of the things that I actually have done through many years is draft evaluations. So I talk a lot to collegiate players going into the pro space and doing draft evaluations. So I hear a lot of what's happening at different universities of what coaches are doing for players. And one of the things I'm hearing a lot of recently is the skill of visualization. The night before game, the coach will guide their players through a visualization routine focusing on whatever the coach really wants to focus on that's most important. But that skill of visualizing, picturing themselves playing well, picturing themselves being resilient, picturing themselves handling different situations. And a coach is actually guiding that visualization routine. I've heard that several times from when I was doing draft evaluations in the NBA. And then when I do them at the NFL, a coach implementing the skill of visualization is key.
Absolutely. Love it. Love it.
I know that was something that was what like Jordan and I think Kobe, all those guys used to do that. Just have like zone in a little mental prep before. I could be mistaken, but I'm almost positive they talked about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Mental reps.
Yeah.
Talk about the term mental rep. It's really just visualizing, picturing yourself executing, but you also want to bring in all the senses. So what do you hear? What do you feel? What do you smell? It's kind of like virtual reality in your brain on steroids, really. But the skill of visualizing is great. Especially, let's say you have a player that's injured and they cannot get the physical reps that they could get the mental reps because they're still reinforcing that movement in their brain. There's neuroscience behind how effective visualization can be. So a coach can easily reinforce that and encourage that.
I love that. I used to tell players, like, when you get injured, it's easy because they can feel like a ghost because they're not involved in the day-to-day. But my thing would be like, look, man or lady, compete as hard against your injury as you would as if you were activated.
Yeah.
So don't turn your competitive juices off. Just redirect it towards competing against this rehab and this recovery. Yes. So that becomes your daily fix to get a competitive bang out of what you're doing. This game, we'll be here when you get back. The game's not going anywhere. So, you know, until you get back, like just rechannel your abilities in this direction.
Yeah. And can we go down this slight tangent for a moment? Cause I'm glad
that Please. You brought up
the injured player and the role of the coach is key. Like you said, a lot of times players can feel out of sight, out of mind and a ghost. That's what said Alan. But if you can incorporate that player as much into practice that they could stand next to you and be a student coach, give them a role, give them a purpose, show them that they can still contribute to the team, even though that they're injured. That's really important. And in the past, I have made some players with long-term injuries my sports psych assistant. And they help me out as a sports psychologist. And it's the players that are very bought in and they love everything mindset, mental, and a lot of their teammates go to them. They're injured. Hey, be my assistant. So as a coach, it's really critical that you still pay attention to that player and you incorporate them as much as you can. I know sometimes, like at the professional level, sometimes when they're on injury reserve, they're only allowed to do so much, but missing them, that's important. And Doug, that kind of goes back to when early questions about trust and creating this culture is one of the components is when you have an athlete that is injured, how do you support that guy? So that they feel that level of trust, even when they're going through a tough time.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you're creating that kid to be a coach before he even knows he wants to be a coach. Like having him stand next to you, start having a little bit of a voice and being a leader. Say if he's a freshman, sophomore, young person, especially at the collegiate level, now you're creating him to be a leader, to be more vocal with the guys and talk about like with everybody, hey, this is what you're doing. This is what coach is trying to have you do. No, that's phenomenal. I think, and that's a great question.
But think about what we always hear players say after they've been injured. Man, it made me look at the game differently.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because they're so used to looking at their own physical or mental lane. I got to do my thing. What's my role? When you got to step back for 3 weeks and watch the group and watch how what you get a perception of what the coaches are actually trying to do. So you got a different perception now because and especially if you're involved and brought into it, like you said, the coach puts you in a passing drill. So now you're like you're injured. You're still a participant in whatever that ways that could look like.
Yep.
But they get this global view all of a sudden for 3 weeks, as opposed to just tunnel vision of handling their own day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if they have an ACL injury, then we know that's 9 months out.
Yeah, right.
So incorporating them. But injury, once again, is opportunity. To go back to your word, Alan, of opportunity. This is opportunity to grow in ways that you didn't necessarily have because you have that tunnel vision of just being on the field. or the court, the floor. Now you could get the big picture. And injury is a great opportunity to really hone in and lead into that mental skill development, because now you might have a little bit more brain space to pay attention to this, where previously you didn't. And then players tend to have a little bit more buy-in when they're going through injury, because now they're facing something they didn't sign up for, they didn't want. It's emotionally hard and challenging. So I've experienced when players haven't been necessarily open to the mental side in the past, that injury process really opens themselves up for it. And then they build skills to help them be even more resilient when they get back on the floor, the court, the field. So coaches can really encourage that and see that as an opportunity for growth for their players too, and encourage them to do their mental skills training.
Yeah, absolutely.
Man, this is great stuff.
We could do a whole series on this. It could be part one of six. Yeah. But no, that's awesome. Love it.
No, I'm honestly coming up with questions over here, and I'm like, all right, we got to let her get back to her job at some point. But
yeah,
I can keep going.
We don't want Sean McDermott, you know, calling us and saying, hey, man, you guys are taking our girls' time up here. But no, this has been awesome.
Yeah, this has been great. This is great because something I've experienced a lot through the years of working with college coaches, professional coaches. There's so many coaches that are eager for skills, tools, resources, training. As a psychologist, I am required to, according to my license, I have to do continuing education credits, X amount every year. So I'm constantly learning and required to get education. It's different in the coaching world, but there's so many coaches who want to upskill themselves as a coach, to help upskill themselves as a performer themselves. Coaches are looking for exactly what we're talking about here, and they're eager for it.
Yeah. Last question before Doug lands the plane, because I thought about this earlier and you were on something else, which is even a great tangent at the time. So it made me forget. But talk about, really, in a compact way, I thought DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love, what they did several years ago, stepping out on stage about mental health, I thought that helped kick down a huge wall in terms of this stigma of something that athletes had typically either been fearful of or fearful to admit. But it's a very real thing. And I thought when those two guys stepped forward, you know, kind of right around that COVID period, you know, right before or after, but they were really transparent and vulnerable about their struggles. But I think it's a great thing, because some of the things that maybe the worst things that happened to them probably are the best things for other people, because these guys paved the way. So just talk about how important it is for players, or for coaches, to encourage players to be vulnerable about this, because I know that's something you deal with every day as well.
Yeah, the mental health piece outside of the sport is also an area that I work on with players. So my job is to help the athlete with their whole mental, emotional, relational space, whether it's related to their sport or not related. And I am in total agreement. There's been a shifting tide over the past, I would say, 15 years, but it's really accelerated since 2020. The past 5 years, with athletes, prominent athletes, being very open and vulnerable about their mental health space. And that has helped others, athletes, and then people in general, just become more open, get the help and resources that they need to navigate it. And it just made the players seem, it just makes professional athletes just seem more real. Like they're just
human.
Humans. That deal with challenges themselves. So everything that the general population deals with and navigates, is our players deal with that too. And the additional challenges of being a professional athlete, like you said, with so many eyes on your work performance. So with those professional athletes becoming open and showing that strength, it has really helped a lot of other individuals and coaches supporting that. Now I would really love more coach models to come out and talk about this as well, to help the coaching population, because coaches have mental health themselves. They have lives, they have families. So that's what I'm hoping the next step is, the coach wave.
I'm sure it's not too far, but no, honestly, like we said in the beginning, to tie it all back to everything, this is all something that is a lot more detrimental and a lot bigger than people know. I think it's absolutely huge. Knowing the psychology side of things, knowing how to communicate with your people, your players, not only your players, but also your other assistant coaches to get your meetings, messages. Like, there's so many avenues that we can go down this, and I'm glad we covered at least a handful of them. So thank you, Dr. Festa. This is amazing just to be able to get to chat with you and get to learn more on this aspect.
This is great. You guys ask such great questions. I see your passion through the screen and the ways you guys are talking too. And this is my intrinsic motivation, just talking to coaches that understand it, they get it, the buy-in, and then we can have these great conversations that time flies as a result.
Yeah, no, thank you again. We all just want to see players get better, and one player at a time. If you make a difference with one player, that's like the whole putting little baby turtles back in the ocean. Probably not a great analogy, but like, you know, it's a million of them out here. What's the difference? What makes a difference to that one? And so, as long as we take that approach, anytime players are at the forefront, ultimately as coaches, if it's a player motivated decision, it's a good thing. Mm. And yeah, this was solid gold. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. And thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course. And everybody, another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Hopefully you took some great information away. If you didn't, rewind it and go back because you missed something. So again, thank you all for tuning in. This was absolutely phenomenal. Again, thank you, Dr. Festa. Doug Caputo, Alan Major here. Keep working, and all you coaches, keep rising. Talk to you all later.
Help your players get more out of their training sessions with our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. As the official shooting machine of Rising Coaches and the number one selling shooting machine in the world, Dr. Dish provides an experience packed with more reps, more motivation, and just plain out more fun. Be sure to mention Rising Coaches for an additional $250 off select Dr. Dish shooting machines. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.